All right, good morning. I'm Brett Edwards. I'm just going to be the moderator for this panel discussion. The panel discussion is, what is the proper place of science in the classical Christian education model? We have three experts here. Philip Arendt, right here. John Mays. And Donna Duarte. The outline is, each one of them will speak for 8 to 10 minutes. After all three have spoken, we'll have a chance for questions directed, obviously, at things they've discussed. If you have a question, there are note cards in front of you. Please write down your question. Place them. Rusty's right down here. Right next to him is our little question area. So throw your questions there. I'll pick up the questions and ask our science teachers these questions. Our first speaker, Philip Arendt, is in his 13th year as a science teacher at Schaefer Academy in Rochester, Minnesota. In 2007, Phil received the Hitachi Teacher Award for the Rochester area and was presented the Excellent Educator Award in September of 2009 by ABC6 News in Rochester. He was awarded the position of a fellow in biomedical imaging research at the Mayo Clinic. He and his wife, Nancy, have 5 children that have all graduated from Schaefer Academy. Go ahead, Phil.
I should say as well, we just had our first grandchild. Unfortunately, being in Minnesota, my grandchild is, my son lives in Baton Rouge, so that's going to be a hard one. I am very blessed to be participating in this. I don't really care for the adjective expert, but sometimes I wonder if several of you should have been courageous enough as I was, or foolish enough to come sit up here with us. But I'm very curious where this discussion will go. Perhaps John, Diane, and I might go in three little different directions. But the thought is, for me, is in what context can this inquiry of science really best rest its head? And I will admit that the atheist modernist seems to fit very well in very successful participation. The individual my school is named after, Francis Schaefer, made an excellent point as how the atheists will borrow from the Christian worldview. And it's my, you know, feelings that this is exactly what's going on with the success that we see. First of all, with the science fitting so well within the Christian commitment, I'm in a Bible study, and an individual in it, when he heard that I was coming here, going to be sharing about chemistry within the Christian context, he made the comment, why? Chemistry is chemistry. For him, he just divorced that from this important point that I feel we're trying to bring across in our time. I believe that our science is justified within our Christian commitment. First of all, we hold as Christians a supernatural ontology, the way things are. Perhaps there are those even within the Christian community who feel that science is somewhat contrary to supernatural ontology. But the laws of physics are not self-existing things. There is a definite need in the teaching of science and to justify as such the view of transcendence, or what we might call the supernatural. I try to teach my students that this is ubiquitous. It is behind every stone that we turn, must be presupposed to justify scientific dependence upon uniformity to maintain the static nature of our inquiries. Also, the issue of miracles. I believe that miracles must be necessary, though rare, in order to confirm that God indeed is governor of the world. And I'm sure that more could be said about anything here. Also, not only a supernatural ontology, but creational metaphysics is the fitting place for science to rest its head. Again, we're perhaps struck with the tension here. Science seems so tied up with evolutionary worldview, but the human need for this intentionality, the creational intentionality, the obvious design, creates such a fit and such a wonder of the study of science. Not only the fit with the Christian commitment, but I believe as well there's a wonderful fit with the inquiry of science into God's world in the classical commitment as well. Within the classical commitment, I believe, we have a full appreciation and utilization of the scientific enterprise. I had another parent approach me with the emphasis that his children, he wants them to do well in science for their future careers, to get a job. He wants them to excel. And his very narrow view of what he expects from our program, I have to address that. I have to help educate that, yes, indeed, I see a good job in store as a nice secondary consequence, but it's not our narrow view. It's not our foundation for what we do, what we do. Within the classical commitment, the Western heritage is taking great strides. A historical context that we have is a beautiful impetus for our students to see. We cannot truncate the classical model to just formal disciplines. That is, logic is just for argument. Rhetoric is just for speaking persuasively. But this classical model, the interdisciplinary principles of learning through the classical model, is a beautiful fit within the scientific enterprise. Science is an excellent discipline to grow the student through the trivium. Grammar, the content, the principles, the uniformities, the laws, the puzzle pieces that the student has to become well-versed in. Logic, the thinking skills developed in problem-solving. Scientific problems are wonderful to develop this growth in dialectic thinking. The rhetoric is the expression, the impact of the skills developed to address the situations. And I'm just, again, so curious as to where our discussion will go today. I'm curious what kind of questions will come from you, and I'm looking forward to seeing how we can best field those. Thank you.
Our next speaker is John Mays. He is has logged 16 years of teaching in high schools and colleges. He served as the Math Science Department Chair at Regent School. He founded Novare Science and Math in 2009 and is the author of the Student Lab Report Handbook, Teaching Science So That Students Learn Science, and Accelerated Studies in Physics and Chemistry, a Mastery-Oriented Introductory Curriculum. He continues to teach physics and mathematics at Regent School of Austin and to develop the laser optics lab there. In addition, he also has a booth here, a Novare booth, if you'd like to visit him at the booth.
So a while back, someone responded to an article that I wrote in my newsletter where I had written on this subject about the interaction between science and the classical education model, where I had affirmed that there is very much a place for science in the model. And I don't remember who this was, but someone wrote to me and said that he was so glad to hear me affirm this because he was a chemistry teacher. And years ago, he had gone to someone in high-profile person in the classical Christian school movement, and had asked, where does chemistry fit in into the classical model? And the answer he received was, it doesn't. So when I wrote my article, he felt like finally that it was affirmed in what he was doing, a chemistry teacher that has a place. And my remarks kind of come out of that interaction with that teacher. I didn't know they were going to publish my remarks in full in the booklet that you have. So you'll forgive me if I just kind of read through them. Hopefully you haven't read them yet, and I can expound on them in the Q&A. But when I have a time limit, I can do a lot better if I read than if I go extemporaneous. That's dangerous. So I'll skip the first point. I just made that. So let's go to the second point. Going back to Plato in the Republic, his rationale for including in his curriculum the arts that would later be called the so-called quadrivium was that they aid us in focusing on the eternal and unchanging realm of being, he called it, rather than the transitory realm of becoming. So the realm of becoming is the temporary things, so they're not worth paying attention to because they're here now and gone later. Plato wants us to cast our minds toward the realm of being, where the forms are, where the eternal things are. That's what he's getting at. So following Plato, all right, so 700 years later, 800 years later, when Martianus Capella created what we now call the seven liberal arts in the 4th century in his book on the marriage of philology and Mercury, he did so by taking the 9 arts proposed by Varro before, which are now lost. We don't have Varro's writings anymore. He took the 9 arts proposed by Varro, and he cut architecture and medicine off the list, and he ended up with the list that we have now: grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, music, geometry, and astronomy. The last 4 being what we call the quadrivium. Now, Capella did this because he felt these 2 arts, medicine and architecture, were too much concerned with the temporal world. Some classical educators stop right here, and they say that based on these considerations, there is no place for studies such as chemistry in the CCE curriculum, contemporary classical and Christian education. Now, one might say that at this point, the 7 liberal arts had long established a pedigree rooted in the transcendent. That's where Plato was directing his writing, toward the realm of the transcendent, the forms. We're going to see that there are other considerations, but even in these terms, we can say that when we study the sciences, we have, as John Polkinghorne has described it, a window into the transcendent. They provide us with a rich and unique perspective from which to contemplate God and his creation. So this is the realm of being. When we're contemplating God through the things that he has made, aren't we in the realm of being? Even though you might be looking at something that physically is passing away, when you look at it and behold the way that the rocks speak to us, the way that the heavens declare the glory of God, they're a window into the transcendent. But there's even more to say about this. As classical educators, if this all we had to go on, this one facet of scientific study would suffice to justify the place of modern sciences in the curriculum. But as CCE educators, we also turn to Scripture for our formational principles. And in the incarnation, we have a deliberate embracing by God of the earthly and temporal. And while it's true that this realm is deeply broken because of the fall, it's also true that God called it good in the beginning when he made it. And the presence of his son here, eating, drinking, going to weddings and feasts, constitutes a blessing on this realm and on our human lives in this realm. And further, we have the consideration of the cultural mandate in Genesis 2:15, where Adam was charged to tend the garden, especially in light of Christ's redeeming physicality, his physical presence here, and his redemption of our bodies, as it is described in Romans 8. These enable us to see that everything we do that satisfies Philippians 4:8 is good for us to do. These include calculus, the pinnacle of mathematical beauty, physics and chemistry, the sustained attempt to model the nature of the matter and energy that God made, and biology, the locus of our physical understanding of just how fearfully and wonderfully made we are. Now, this last thought suggests that as we study God's works, we are indirectly studying Him. To know and contemplate these subjects and others like them is to confront huge issues, such as the creative processes God used to bring us here, God's interactions with time, energy, and matter, the profound mathematical structure of creation, which continues to astonish, and God's desires for us in terms of how we use and steward natural resources. We were never meant to contemplate only being, as if the material world were of no account. That is Gnosticism. God loves the world He made, and our lives in it, and our task is to live redemptively in the world, the realm of becoming. I might add that all the attempts to separate the physical from the spiritual, I think, are misguided. Okay? I like to use this metaphor. If you try to describe light as a wave, okay, you're getting a partial description. If you try to describe it as a partial description, right? It's a duality. It's both. Christ is a man and He's God. You can't separate them. He's in a third category, the both category, right? Well, that applies to us in the physical world too. We aren't just souls that happen to have bodies. We aren't just bodies that evolved from the slime and somehow souls came in. Okay? We are embodied, ensouled beings that are immortal. So if we try to separate the physical and the spiritual, we do this because if we need to analyze, and analysis happens when you separate and you try to break down and understand. So analysis is part of modern thinking. Classical thinking might engage in analysis, but it's never loses sight of the whole. And the whole for us is that we are eternal creatures created with the image of God, in the image of God, and we inhabit a physical realm. I'll skip the side note there as in the interest of time. Hopefully, you can go back and read it later. I just think it's ironic that the sciences are always called upon to justify their inclusion in the curriculum when, studying Jane Austen doesn't need justification. She's no more classical than chemistry. I love Jane Austen, right? Don't misunderstand me. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of chemistry, too. All right, finally, when we compare the CCE curriculum to the modern curriculum, they may look similar in the sciences, superficially. They both include physics, chemistry, and biology, but these subjects are taught for quite different reasons in the two curricula. For the moderns, the sciences are strictly practical. Good citizens and workers need a practical education. We CCE educators must also bow to the practical at some level. After all, our students do need to meet the entrance requirements for the colleges, our schools go out of business. So we have practical considerations we must worry about. But the beautiful thing is this. With classical and Christian education, we get the practical benefits of scientific study thrown in for free. When we target the practical as an end in itself, as modern education would have it, we lose the transcendent entirely. Then we are truly lost, cut off from our moorings to the absolute, and adrift in a sea of physical objects without meaning and with a mysterious mathematical structure that cannot be explained. This is not a satisfying place to be. But for us, in the classical and Christian environment, the inclusion of these subjects is justified on these more noble principles that I've already described. We enjoy the practical benefits that inevitably follow.
All right, about 10 more minutes to get your questions right down here by Rusty. If you just want to wait till they're done speaking to bring them up, that's fine. Either way, our third speaker, Donna Duarte, is the chemistry and earth science instructor at Rockbridge Academy in Millersville, Maryland, where she has taught for the past 7 years. After completing her graduate research at NASA's Langley Research Center, Donna managed an environmental testing laboratory near Monterey, California. She is the wife of a retired naval officer, mother of three, lover of opera, and Rockbridge Academy's varsity girls basketball coach.
In soccer, they call this position the sweeper. I'm supposed to fill in the gaps. So the proper place of science in CCE. Well, I think we have to start by recognizing this. No child walks into the door of kindergarten as a committed, materialistic, naturalistic atheist. That takes years of conditioning to beat out of people that are made in the image of God. Right? They come to us with wonder and questions and humility. Maybe not with each other, but toward creation. They want to know, why does that work? How does that work? So how do we handle that? Well, I think it is our job to cultivate observant people. We do not live in a culture that cultivates observant people. I have to send seventh graders home to ride their bicycle, to throw a baseball, to go out on the porch or walk as far away as you have to get to a dark spot so you can see the stars at night. Creation is declaring the glory of God, but we're not listening. This generation is not looking. That's our job. We wow them. We crush Coke cans with cold water. We boil water with a vacuum pump. We do things that they do not think is possible. We let them touch it and taste it and feel it and smell it and not be willing to buy simple, trite answers, but to be amazed at God and his creation. We need to facilitate a biblical understanding of God's constant governance and care for his creation and his people. If you haven't had a chance to read Vern Poitras's Redeeming Science, you should. He makes an eloquent argument for the fact that when we see the laws of science at work, that's not a deistic observation. That is the hand of the Logos, Jesus, the divine order of creation at work. And that's not nature. That's God. We have to instill a sense of responsibility for doing good to others, using the order that's within creation. When we do things with science and technology, we're not doing them, right? God is doing them. We are being students of how nature works, and we are guiding it toward an end that we desire. Which is a huge responsibility, because what do I desire? 2.5 kids, big house, and a fancy car. Or clean drinking water in sub-Saharan Africa. Those are two very different things. We have to bring that sense of responsibility to our students. We need to stir contemplation. As John has said, you know, science doesn't give us hard and fast certain answers about nature, but it sure does provoke us to think and reflect. We need to model the proper Christian epistemology. Our students are watching. I talk to our grammar teachers about this all the time. Be careful what you say when you say, we know. Do you mean we think? Do you mean we postulate? Do you mean that we explain? Because students are learning epistemology in the third grade. They're learning epistemology in kindergarten. Let's be careful how we talk to them. And we need to bear the burden of reintegrating our subjects into the Christian worldview, as Dr. Poythress has argued in his book. As scientists, we bear the responsibility of this reintegration, because I'm a chemist, and I love opera, and I love basketball, and I love poetry, and I love my children, and I love my church, but the lit teacher may not really love physics, right? So we're in the place of having this love in our hearts for the order and that God has revealed to us in his creation, and loving all those other things too. So who's going to pursue the integration, them or us? It has to be us, I think. Remember, science is a human endeavor. Is that the 3M commercial? I don't remember. But it is a human endeavor, right? And it's done best by people who are comfortable being human, loving beauty, having desires, wanting to achieve ends, being comfortable in our own skin. And I'd like to jump on to one of John's comments about the place of the quadrivium. I do think that has a place in what we're doing, even though we talk about the trivium. We are teaching math. I would assume that most of us in here are teaching math or teaching science at some level. And so we should be pursuing some of those ends. Because, as Plato argued, as we go from the sensory realm to the realm of the forms, what do we pass through? We pass through those mathematical models of what we experience to try to achieve those forms. Now, can we do that? Can we achieve that? We don't have to. Our God came to us. He's spoken to us in his word. Right? But boy, what a common ground with the world and the culture that we live in and the values that they have, to go to them on their terms and say, this is the reason that this works. Thank you.
All right, please deliver your questions right down here. I think you all will agree we have three pretty impressive presentators here. I want to just, if from their bios, read three different things. We have Philip with the biomedical imaging research at the Mayo Clinic. We have John Mays with the Laser Optics Lab. And we have Donna at NASA's Langley Research Center. The best I can offer is building a Lego castle with my little daughter, but... Let me grab these questions. Let me, just so I don't have to search through these, let me throw out a question just to get us started so we don't waste some time. Speakers, if you can just stay seated and use the microphone in front of you. I was talking with a math science teacher in my area, and we were just kind of thinking, what's the balance between laboratory exercises, hands-on, observation? We're thinking within the classical Christian school model, the classical Christian school emphasis, and more of the instructional information cramming textbook, you know, material. Is classical Christian school gonna balance on one side more than the other? What do you guys think? Does that question make sense?
Is this? Yes, it is. You know, I think it's interesting with a modernist perspective versus the classical, that people will walk into my lab and see, you know, thankfully, some of the sophisticated equipment and think of it as classical. But in a very practical sense, we have a lab approximately once a week. Our schedule is such that I find it a little unfortunate. I don't know if others here can address that our schedule is about a 50-minute class segment, so it's difficult sometimes to accommodate a lab in a shorter class segment, so sometimes I have to beg, borrow, and steal in the schedule to be able to accommodate that. But that's sort of the instruction lab continuity that we try to maintain.
Well, professor on a hands-on way of integrating a lab on electric circuits into a classroom. But since then, I've really come to look at it differently. The public school requirement back when I was teaching in public schools was 40% of the class devoted to laboratory time. Now, they did include demonstrations and things like that, a number of which allowed me to need it, but I, as a physics teacher, I just didn't think that was the right balance. So here are the principles that I think came with. Number one, as classical educators, there is a good tradition in classical education of imitation. When we are not arrived to imitate and we do it ourselves. So I think the idea that everything has to be discovered depends on experience, a discovery-oriented laboratory type experience is misguided. I need to tell you what to do, but I need to set up the lab in a way that you're going to have an experience with this material that will really help you appreciate the physical principles involved. There are times when I will construct a lab activity where the students have to figure it out for themselves. I don't do that until the senior year. With younger grades, I know what to do, but I try to construct the lab in a way that it's very exciting and interesting, which is hard. That's going to be boring. A third thing I would say is that the right balance between
John, can you come up here?
Hold on.
They like this mic better, I guess.
Yeah. It's going upstairs somehow, so we're going to have to use this mic.
Oh, dear. Can I have that mic back just to apologize? Someone pass our apologies on up there. Good grief. Good for business. So the last thing I was going to say is that I think the balance shifts in different kinds of science classes. The biology classes that I'm familiar with at Regent School where I've been teaching, they do labs very frequently, certainly every week they are in the lab, whereas in physics it's much less frequently. So I think that's just a difference in the nature of the disciplines. So I'll leave it at that. Those are my few remarks.
I like this position. Yeah, I think what I would add to that is just we need to think in the framework of the trivium. It really depends on what stage we're dealing with. In the grammar classroom, I'm constantly telling all my colleagues it's all about the wow factor. I'll explain it later. Can you just wow them? Can you show them? Can you take them? Can you collect? Can you sort? Can you look? Can you... It really stirs their sense of wonder and vocabulary. Putting a good vocabulary to what they see that's going to allow us to build on that in the logic stage. In the logic, I teach seventh grade earth science. We do a lot of tell and then do. If you come to my talk this afternoon, we're going to talk about Eratosthenes calculating the circumference of the earth. I tell them about that. And then I make them do it. So that they're getting higher things that they're not really comfortable with, but then they're connecting it back to this is a protractor and this is a ruler, and let's go to work. And then in chemistry, I completely agree with John. It's all about impact. You know, first day of chemistry, all the students want to know, what are we blowing up this year? And how many times? And I say, we'll blow something up when it means something to you. Because otherwise it's just fireworks, which are fun, but they're not really necessarily instructive. So,
you guys were only supposed to give me about 5 or 6 questions, but you gave me about 30 to 35. So I'll do the best I can. I've tried to organize them in groups. You don't. Yeah, you don't. Yeah. But I'll try to do ones where I saw more than one in the same category. Advanced placement courses in the science, in the classical Christian education model. You know, what's the proper place for them? Looking at how some even big private schools, not necessarily Christian, are dropping the whole AP. They're done with it. So your thoughts on AP, and is it too restrictive to our model?
Well, we at Schaefer, we have authorized AP in physics, pursuing it in chemistry. I do have my difficulties with it in that when I teach AP physics, when I have taught it, I feel very constrained that I have to go a certain route. I am constrained to be able to deliver this product so that my students can do well on an exam. And it really ties me to not go off onto the trails of learning that I would love to go off on and perhaps take more time on things than this rigor of being able to prepare students for a test would allow. Just the depth of the love of learning and... although we are pursuing expanding our AP offerings, and a lot of our students in other disciplines, even though they don't have an authorized AP course that they would take, they still are well enough prepared to sit and do well on the exams. So it's a two-sided thing for me. Even though we pursue it, it's a difficult shoe for me with the way I just like to wing it sometimes, and even though we have our rigor, I like to go off on rabbit trails, and I feel prohibited sometimes. I don't know if you two wanted to weigh in.
Some science and math courses line up very well between what you would want to do as a classical Christian teacher and what the AP syllabus requires. Examples are AP statistics and AP calculus. In those cases, offer the AP courses would be my answer. Sometimes the AP syllabus does not line up well with what a classical Christian teacher wants to do. An example is physics. They don't line up at all. So in that case, don't teach the AP syllabus. Teach a good physics class would be my recommendation, and that's what we've always done. A third category is classes that could line up well, but the laboratory requirement is so massive that you may have really serious practical limitations. And biology and chemistry are examples of that. You can't offer them unless you can figure out how to work two-hour labs into your curriculum, and lots of them. And so now you're talking about a real logistical hurdle, and that might be the reason you need to not do them. Or if you're going to do them, you're going to have to figure out those logistics. So I think they fall into three categories, and that's how I've always solved the problem.
Our next batch is integration of the sciences with humanities. For example, consider the kind of integration that we have with the omnibus textbook, art, history, literature, how to best pursue integration between the disciplines.
It's an advertisement for my 3 o'clock talk. The history of science is replete with men and women just like us who had, by God's grace, insight into how things work, or at least how to effectively model how things work. And we must tell those stories. We must tell those stories. Our students must know those stories. But here's the dirty little secret. We have to know those stories. And we don't, well, you may. But when I got my master's degree in chemistry, I didn't know any stories. I knew the names of men who had equations named after them. That was my science history. That's it. That's all I knew. And these capture the hearts of students. These stories capture the hearts of students. I can't think of his name right now, but the guy that was trying to elucidate the structure of cyclohexane, right? And he tried and tried and tried, and he almost gave up, and he said, "That's it, I'm not going to try anymore." And, you know, and he goes to bed and he has a dream, and the snake wraps around and bites his own tail. And he says, "That's it. I can't figure out the structure because it's not a straight chain, right? Our students lack confidence that they can do this. And when you tell them that Isaac Newton first had the idea that white light was complex and that the different colors bent at different angles, like a tennis ball that was hit with a nice topspin, when it goes over the net and it sinks, they can't believe that. What does tennis have to do with science? Right? But it's analogical thinking. That's how we think as scientists. So that's my plug for integration is tell the stories, talk about how we use models from all areas of our life when we're trying to model the behavior of creation.
If you come by my booth, you'll see integration is one of the three words that I talk about all the time. I don't think really you can do a good job of science teaching unless integration is part of what you do. I just think a science class without bringing in English language skills, historical elements, the understanding that science is part of God's world made by Jesus and it gives glory to him, mathematics, connection to mathematics, an awareness of terminology that's derived from Latin or Greek, et cetera. I mean, these connections are ever present. And I just don't think a science class will be a very good class if it leaves these out. In fact, it will be reduced to mere knowledge of facts as they are today, as we understand them today, and there won't be any substance behind those. If you want students to understand the way science works as model building, okay, which is the way I describe it in my book, science is a model building process. We're building models, mental models of the way the world works, and these models evolve as we learn new things. So how does this process of model building work? So I want my students to understand that because I think if you don't understand it, you don't really understand science. Science is kind of interesting this way. It's not just the facts and theories that make up the body of the discipline. It's also how are these things processed that is part of it. If you don't understand that, you don't really understand science. And the history allows us to see that model building in process. If you watch how the models of the atom went from Dalton and Thomson and Rutherford and on through, you can see the model taking shape as people try different things. The same thing in the Copernican Revolution. If you go from Ptolemy through the revolutionary period, ending up with Einstein's general theory of relativity, these models, each one is a new attempt to try to explain the way things are as best we can. It's not the truth. It's a model of the reality that is the truth that we're trying to describe. And that model building process, if you know the history of the models, how they went from one to the next, you're learning how science works by learning those histories. Plus, you get the side benefit of the cool stories, like Tycho Brahe getting his nose cut off in a duel, stuff like that. Okay, so very much think that in the sciences, integration is a critical element of a course that is what it should be.
I'm doing my best, people. Say, if your question doesn't get answered, you know, come up afterwards. Can classical works in science, i.e. Aristotle's Physics, Lucretius's On the Nature of Things, Newton's Principia and Optics, Lavoisier's Chemistry, Boyle's Skeptical Chemist, etc., be used effectively with rhetoric stage students? If so, to what extent and in what role?
I'm actually, as we speak, plugging through Aristotle's Physics, and I found it very helpful. So I'm a little bit on the infancy of what, obviously, who asked the question? Yeah, have you pursued and found success? And I mean, it would be a good. I'm a very excerpt kind of reader, so I dig and I pull out what I want my students to know. But as far as being very well versed in some of the more ancient works like this,
I've read
yes. Well, has anyone found success? As I said, I'm bringing bits and pieces in for my students, and I think it'd be very, very helpful. But I'm... Yes?
I purchased a book called The History of Astronomy, which starts essentially with Hipparchus and ends with Stephen Hawking. And it is the children love it. And we're going through our curriculum to bring in...
At what age level? Right. You know, my off-the-cuff thought would be in my plodding through Aristotle's physics this summer, I'm seeing what I've been told firsthand. And to be able to give that discovery to students, I think, is a very noble goal for us to pursue. Why was it that Galileo and Aristotle disagreed on motion? How was it that Aristotle and Democritus disagreed upon the continuity of matter versus the particulate nature? It's fascinating. Yes. Yes. Could you say the name?
The History of Astronomy by Peter Otten.
The History of Astronomy by Peter Otten. Okay. Thank you.
I can't speak from personal experience, but my predecessor did use Michael Faraday's The Chemical History of the Candle and talked a little bit about that. And so our juniors would use different lessons from his public lectures to demonstrate the various principles that are there. And they had great success with it. We've gone away from it because of many other things that we do in the junior year, but I know that it was successful.
All right. While obtaining my PhD in chemistry in a top research lab, I noticed two things. Most top researchers worldwide do not believe in God, let alone Jesus Christ. Most team members of these labs are from abroad. They are atheist, Hindu, Buddhist. Praise the Lord for being born again, but how do you face this epidemic, considering, I guess, we get our students excited for science, we're sending them into this type of environment?
That is a really challenging question. I like to start thinking about an answer to a question like that by considering that our mandate from our Holy Father is to go and tend our garden. We've been given a cultural mandate by Him. And I believe that means go and develop the full capabilities which human beings are capable of in every sphere, and do so to God's glory. That is our mandate. If we turn over any part of our garden to those who do not fear the Lord, I think that is a failure on our part. I encourage my students, I say to them, every one of you who has the intellectual capacity to get a PhD should consider it seriously. You should consider seriously doing so. You may not do it. You should at least consider it, that God might be pointing in that direction. Christians have abandoned the academy, and the academy is now a haven for atheism, but we abandon it. That's why it's like that. It didn't used to be like that. It became like that. So I believe it is our responsibility to think about this seriously and to encourage people to take it on. And that means it's hard and it's challenging. The second aspect of this question that occurs to me is that we need to do a good job with our students while we have them. The last thing I want to happen to my daughters or any of my students is to go to college and lose their faith because I did a bad job when they were at home and at school. And they go out and they learn things that just blow their faith completely out of the water. And we've all seen this happen. What I rejoice at is when students go through a course of instruction and they come out at the end of it in their high school years and their faith is robust and they're not afraid of any scientific thing. I'm not afraid. I'm going to write an article one of these days called Fearlessly Scientific. Okay? I've already written it. I just haven't published it yet. Okay? But fearlessly scientific. I am not afraid of scientists and their claims. All right? Maybe evolution happened. I don't know. But if it did, it's because God made it happen. Okay? And if it didn't, it's because God made it not happen. All right? God was the creator. And we can debate about the mechanisms. And different Christians, of course, have different positions. That's fine. We can debate that. God's the creator. God created life. God created human beings in his image. He's the creator. All right? So when I teach students, I want to prepare them. Sure, understand what everybody else is saying, but understand why your faith makes total sense. Your faith explains things. Okay? Why are things so broken? Why does everybody tend towards evil? There are reasons for this that are explained by our precious faith. All right, so I think we need to do our jobs well to equip our students with knowledge of and understanding of the faith and why that is not a problem in the context of science so that they can go to college armed, not disdainful. Okay, I am not preaching that or saying that we should preach to our students that they should disdain everybody. That's an error. Okay, I don't even like it when people say Darwin was an evil man. Well, he wasn't. He was a man like me, okay? We are both evil men, okay? He was also a brilliant researcher, okay? So let's quit talking this way. Quit dissing people just because they're associated with a worldview that you don't like, all right? Let's teach our children to respectfully engage their interlocutor and understand the other person's point of view and be respectful when referring to them, and get their name right, and don't take their statements out of context to twist their points of view. All right, let's give them full credit, and let's treat them with respect. And when there are apparent disagreements between their claims and our faith position, let's respectfully dialogue about that and say, well, let me understand you. Are you saying, oh, well, here's what I think. How does that fit? Okay, let's respectfully dialogue with them. When we model this to our students, they just love it. I'll say one more thing. I have seen this happen over and over. When a classroom is structured so that the word evolution is a bad word, the students actually live in fear because they are so threatened by the discontinuity between what the whole world is saying and what their church and their school is saying, that they are absolutely terrified that they're going to get caught in the middle of this unbridgeable discontinuity. And they don't like that position, and they won't talk because they might say the wrong thing and be judged as, oh, one of those people. But watch what happens in a classroom if you give them the freedom to discuss this and you say, evolution, we're not going to say whether it happened or not as a physical thing. What we're going to say is God made this place here, and now we're going to look at the different theoretical models, and we're going to look at what Scripture has to say, and we're going to compare these things, and we're going to discuss them, and we're going to talk about this openly. And when we get done, I want you to be able to tell me what evolution is all about. I want you to be able to tell me what the Bible has to say and the different ways of interpreting the biblical literature on this subject. And I want you to feel like you've engaged intellectually in this interaction. You watch what happens when you do that. Kids, you can almost hear a physical sigh of relief in a biology class when this kind of freedom is presented to the students, and they suddenly will start talking and questioning and getting involved and reading books and giving essay and reports to the class, treating it like a school.
I'm interested to see where this one goes. Classical education is, among other things, training for liberty. How does the study of biology, chemistry, etc., help me be truly free?
Free to do what? Free to do what? Free to exercise the cultural mandate? Free to do good to others? Free to do good to your enemies? Free to show kindness? That's engineering. That's fundamental science, giving explanations on disease. Telling my parents that, you know, my brother was not born deaf because they sinned, but that there was a genetic disorder. Right? That redefined God in the lives in my parents' life. So how could it not set us free?
I'm not good at this panel thing because I have an atheist brother who I can debate with. He's very bright. I can debate with very well doing emails back and forth. But sitting back and forth, I say, okay, give me an hour and I'll get right back to you on that topic. But you know, a freedom, again, can be defined differently. Freedom being just the right to do what I want or the ability to do what I ought to do. And I think having a robust science program to be able to equip students, to be able to have then the ability to exercise in areas where they did not have the freedom by which to exercise in those areas might be one little piece of the puzzle that's being asked.
Do you have a follow-up?
Well, I kind of did, because Mr. Mays, I think, really answered that question, because it gives us the ability to be free with our faith, that we know the truth, and that truth sets us free, and that we're able to study the sciences in an open form, and be able to say, God is our creator. So really and truly, and then that takes away that whole lack of scaffolding in some Christian schools, where our kids go out
If schools don't provide an opportunity for students to talk openly and honestly on hard questions, and it's not just the sciences that have hard questions, right? I mean, think about Catholic Protestant issues, right? There are plenty of hard questions. Predestination is one that our students love to debate. Every year there's a debate on predestination. If we don't give them a freedom to intellectually engage these things, that's when they go off to college and get smashed. It's because they've never had the opportunity to do this before. They've been just spoon-fed things, and they go off, and the first time those things that they've been taught in this sort of sealed environment, the first time they're exposed to some environment where those thoughts are challenged, the whole thing collapses, and the kid comes home and says, well, I lost my faith. That's a travesty of education. Our job is to prepare them to think. Okay, we give them certain tools. Okay, laws of physics, laws of chemistry, how to write a lab report. Okay, we give them tools, but we want to teach them how to think. The whole life that they live is going to be a life of engaging questions like this, if they're being faithful. Okay, they can live, they can watch TV for the rest of their lives if they want. That's not a faithful way to live. If they're going to live faithfully, they're going to be out talking with people, interacting, ministering, and working. And if they do that, they're going to be engaging hard questions. And I don't want the first time they ever hit one of those questions to occur in their sophomore biology class, where they just get hammered and think, oh, everything everybody ever told me was wrong. If I tell them, I don't know the answer to this. If I tell them, this is a hard one. I've been studying this 15 years. I've read every book. I still don't know the answer. But let's talk. Let's understand. Okay, I give them the freedom to already know. It's okay. You don't have to feel like you understand everything. There are grown people who've been reading for years who don't understand everything. If they can get that in their head and learn how to entertain and discourse on the various ideas, then when one of these happens in college, they go, that's okay. I've been doing this all my life. I already know what it feels like for someone to say something that's different from certain things I've been told. I have mental categories for that. So let's go. Let's have the conversation. That, I think, yeah, is being set free.
Last question. We're about at our time. But if your question did not get answered, please find them afterwards. Why is there so little emphasis in science in many classical schools? In my school, science holds the lowest priority, and I think many others can probably resonate with this.
I can just briefly say that, unfortunately, a lot of our Western Christian culture has adopted a pietistic sort of view on spirituality at times, as maybe John had shared in his opening statements, the separation that science becomes something that is questioned as threatening to the Christian view, as I said at the beginning. And I'm sure you have testimonies of parents who come into the school a little bit, with these questions about evolution, et cetera, that sort of demonize what you're trying to accomplish and the breadth that you want to teach and the beauty and the wonder. And so just a couple of thoughts is possibly why. Any other?
I will have to hold my remarks on this question real shortly. I don't want to sound self-serving in the way I answer the question. I think science, in particular, has the lowest priority because we don't know how to teach it well, and we haven't questioned what a classical approach looks like compared to what the public schools do. And I don't want to mean this as a general blanket sort of indictment, because I've talked to a lot of science teachers, and there's a lot of people doing a lot of really hard work, okay? But I think that we haven't adequately distinguished what makes teaching science classically and in a Christian school, what does that look like? And by far, what you see mostly, even in accomplished classical Christian schools, walk into the chemistry classroom, sit through 5-6 sessions, and then compare with what you would see at any public school. A lot of times I think you're going to see not that much difference, which begs the question, okay, what is it that needs to be different? And the reason I said I didn't want to sound self-serving is because my whole project as an author and a speaker is directed at this. How do we sort of transform math and science education so that they are faithfully taught from a classical and Christian point of view? And I think that's where we have much work to do.
Okay, John won't be self-serving, so I'll serve him. I think the answer to that question is a lot of times me, you. That's why. As scientists, we don't typically tend to be the most socially polished, eloquent, you know. I tell my kids, you know, Mendeleev and Meyer discovered the periodic, the something like the current formulation of the periodic table right about the same time. We know about one. We don't know about the other. Why? He went to cocktail parties. We have to do our homework. We have a lot of hard work to do. We have to bridge the gap. The burden is on us. We have to read. We have to study. We have to be good apologists for what the Lord has called us to do.
I just want to quickly follow up. I guarantee you, if you build a laser optics lab at your school, it will become a priority. So, anyways, thank. Let's give it up for our speakers. They did a great job.